What's up, everyone? Welcome to episode 8 of From the Beginning. Today, I sat down with the founder and CEO of Penn Station East Coast Subs, Jeff Osterfeld. And we talked for a long time, so I actually decided to change things up, as you probably saw when you clicked on this episode, and break it down into three different parts. So in part one, which you're listening to right now, we'll break down the actual story behind Jeff's life, his journey leading up to the moment where he founded Penn Station. In part two, we'll get into the nitty-gritty. We'll talk about some of the details. I'll ask him some questions, more specifics about his life and about his journey. And in part three, we cover Jeff's decision to design and run his own golf course, as well as some of the questions that you're used to me asking the guests towards the end of our episodes. So what he has planned for the future, any advice he has as he looks back and reflects on his journey, etc. So without any further ado, we'll go ahead and jump right into part one. I hope you enjoy it. Jeff, thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad I could make it, Chris. Good to meet you.
We're trying out kind of a new dialogue here. I think before there was a little bit more fluff. And so I really just kind of want to dive right into it and starting with, you know, where you're from, what your background is like.
Gotcha. I grew up in Cincinnati, family of six. My father was one of those old school guys, and we worked and worked. He was in contracting. We used to clean up his lots. There were four boys. And we were out there at 8, 9, 10 years old, picking up bricks and putting them in drywall buckets and burning old timber and all that kind of stuff. And work ethic was a big part of who you were. And frankly, amongst the four of us, we all knew the way to make dad happy was, which is what you want to do at that age, was to be the hardest worker out there. So we all grew up with a work ethic. He was self-employed. His father was self-employed. So I kind of knew I always wanted to do something on my own. And painting houses in high school with a couple of friends. We were painting for college guys. You know, at the end of the year, the guy was selling his business and he came to me and said, hey, $1,000 you can buy my ladders and the jacks and the brushes, et cetera. And you're in business for yourself next summer. So I got a taste early on at 17 or 18. I think junior and senior year, I was painting houses. I was clueless, you know, didn't know what I was doing. But what I learned was I enjoyed being the boss. I enjoyed the way the capitalist part of that work. You go out and hustle and line up houses and get people to work at the time. Really, it was $4, $5, $6 an hour. This was in the early 80s. But you found that you were competing with people that were 25 and 30 and 30 and 40 years old. And here we are, just a bunch of high school and college guys slapping a coat of latex paint on some older homes around town. But I found by the end of the summer, I was making more like $30 or $40 an hour instead of $3 or $4 or $5 an hour. And I got a taste of what it was like to have people working for you and the responsibilities that come with that. And I enjoyed it. So I did that all the way through high school and through college. In the winters, I went to Miami University. In the winter, we had a 6-week break. I could take off those 6 weeks and paint indoors in Cincinnati. So it was really a perfect college student job, the painting business was. But it opened my eyes, and I acknowledged that I was making $8,000 and $10,000 in a summer, and there was no way I was going to go to work for IBM for $10,000 or $12,000 or $14,000 a year. I knew that too. So I started looking my senior year. The entrepreneur thing was in the blood. There was a couple of sub shops in Oxford, uptown Miami, including the Oxford Bagel and Deli. And they had a place called the Philadelphia Sub Shop. And I copied some of what each of the two of those had on their menu and thought, what the heck, when I graduate, I'm going to go into the restaurant business. And I was met with some skeptics. And frankly, if somebody was marrying my daughter and they came to me, and my father-in-law worked for USU, he was kind of a bigwig at USU, and said, hey, I'm this guy playing rugby in college and I want to take your daughter and I'm a house painter and I've never been in the restaurant business. And yes, I graduated from Miami, but I'm pretty happy making cheesesteaks and bagel sandwiches and good Lord, he scratched that, and I don't blame him. I was clueless, no question about it. I look back at some of the stuff in 83 and 84 when I first opened that I didn't know, but you figure it out over time. You know, I saved money, frankly, from the painting business. I was in the Sigma Chi house at Miami in 1982 in March and April, and I'm negotiating a lease There were no cell phones. So I'm in a common phone in the middle of a frat house with 80 guys with a finger in one ear and pressing the phone to my other ear, talking to the DeBartolo Corp in Youngstown, Ohio, about wanting to get into a shop, one of their shopping malls. And they ended up giving me a lease in Dayton Mall. And I didn't tell them I'm in a frat house with my finger in my ear and I got it at 3 o'clock last night, you know. And they ended up giving me a lease in Dayton Mall, where I kind of copied some of the things I learned from the other restaurants up in Oxford. And I opened up Jeffrey's Bagel and Deli in the mall. I later came to find out that there were 17 entrances in the mall. And when you were in the middle of the traffic flow at the apex, if you will, of some of the or the junction of some of the hallways, you did great. But guess what? Of the 17 entrances, I was right inside the entrance out of the main concourse, and it was the least trafficked entrance of the mall. It was 17 out of 17. I didn't know these things.
Not something that they tell you when you first sign the lease.
No, but most of that stuff's common sense. You figure it out as you go. I know the end of my first year, I remember tallying up my hours, and I think I made $19,000. And at the time, that wasn't too bad. You know, it was okay if you went out, like I said, and got a job with IBM or somebody for those kind of dollars, you were pretty happy. But when I divided the hours I worked, I made less than my hourlies. We were $3.50 an hour, $3.50 an hour. But that's kind of how it worked. What it did was open my eyes, give me access to the business, and help me understand what it takes to make money. The mall then put a food court in the center concourse. I moved, modified the menu a little bit from Jeffrey's Bagel and Deli to a little broader version, Jeffrey's Deli. And I started adding different sandwiches to the menu. There was a Steak Escape that was their second store, I believe, in the food court. And their lines were across the front of the taco place and lined up across the front of my store every day at lunch. So, of course, I started selling sandwiches to their customers waiting in their line in the back of line, 24, 25 years old, just had a baby, and I got bills to pay. So I said, hey, I got roast beef back here in this little grill. I'll just throw the roast beef on it, grill some white onions, and I can make you a cheesesteak better than that. They kept up, you know, 6 months a year doing these huge volumes, way more than I was in the deli. So I got this idea of combining kind of the deli and the cheesesteak fair, and open up a store in downtown Cincinnati. At the time, I'm living in North Cincinnati, driving a half an hour north to Dayton every day and in the Dayton Mall. But so in 1985, I opened, I went out to Pat's and Geno's, all the places out on the East Coast in Philadelphia and South Philly, where the cheesesteak originated. I went to a place called the White House in Atlantic City, where, and it was the big famous sub shop in Atlantic City. So I took the origination of the East Coast sub, cheesesteaks and Italians and all that kind of stuff, learned, just spent 2 days out there when I didn't have two nickels to rub together, really. Talking to their employees at night and after close and whatever, and learning as much as I could, came home, pieced a menu together, and opened up Philadelphia Steak and Sub down on Walnut Street in downtown Cincy in August of 1985. And right out of the chute, that went pretty well. So, you know, you were lined to the door, but any successful place in a downtown atmosphere was, because you had basically 11 to 2 to make your nut. What I also learned is I didn't have Saturday, Sunday, or Saturday night or Sunday night. There's nobody downtown. So I was limited to 20 or 22 meal periods a month, as opposed to 60 meal periods a month. I opened two or three other stores outside of the city into suburbia, if you will. And they did okay. And I got to where I'm running around between four or five stores and, you know, 25, 26, 27 years old, trying to do everything myself. I had to learn the hard way that that doesn't work. You have to learn to delegate. I remember coming to my dad frustrated with, I think I had four stores open at the time. And it's like, you know, I got a problem in the store in Clifton on the UC campus. And so I spent 2 months there, got the staff cleaned up, everybody trained, and the store over on Kemper Road started falling apart. The manager walked out, deposits were disappearing. And I ran around like a chicken with my head cut off. And I made money in one or two, broke even in one, and losing money in another, you know, and I'm not treading water. I'm making a living, but not much of a living. And it wasn't headed where I wanted it to go. And my dad, you know, kind of gave me this speech about chiefs and Indians. And he said, your problem is that you're a chief and you want to be in charge and in control, and you expect all these people at $4 an hour to treat the business the way you do. They don't go to bed at night thinking every waking hour about their business. It's a job for them. And in a lot of occasions, as you know, high school and college kids, it's they're not feeding a family. You know, it's beer drinking money for the weekend. So you got some of that attitude. And the managers, too, didn't treat it, I didn't feel like, ever the way I did. So I actually went to three guys that painted for me in college, in high school and college. John Doyle, my brother, Kevin Osterfeld, a guy named Jeff Seaman, and said, hey, guys, you know, I'm going to keep a company-owned unit, but I'm going to start franchising. My lawyer specialized for his firm in franchise law and educated me about franchising. But I did that with the idea that I knew my food was good. And if I had people behind that counter every day, if I had four of me who cared as much as I cared in behind that counter every day, I knew the product was good enough that, and if the food's made right, that eventually we'd have great success. So I sold three of the store's office franchises, kept a training center, and started selling franchises. And really, we blossomed largely when that happened. I didn't know. I got into franchising for the right reason, but I didn't really know what the word meant in college. I remember hearing it. In the end, I view it as kind of a distribution system. I've got a business model that works under a certain set of circumstances. If I can get people to invest who feel the way I do and are as passionate as I am and as detailed and work like I did behind every one of those counters, I know it's going to take off. And that's what franchising did for me. So the three stores, of course, the food costs dropped. The sales went up. I remember going to the store on Kemper Road. The 9 to 10 o'clock hour shrunk from $60 an hour to 30. Well, that doesn't happen when the business is growing. And I'm talking to the manager and he doesn't know what it is. And, you know, I just don't think people like to eat the food late at night. I knew that was hogwash. So I go up to Miami. I play golf late in the afternoon. I come back and sit in the parking lot from 9 to 10 because I'm passing this on the way home. And I'm sitting there just watching from outside. And sure enough, at 5 after 9 or 10 after 9, the chairs go up on top of the table. The guy's out with the mop bucket. The sign gets turned off at 9:30. So I got up at 5 till 10, you know, walked in and the door was open. And I asked him about all the pre-closing. And, you know, you got a bunch of dumbfounded looks from people who weren't as interested as I was because it was affecting my pocketbook. And that was kind of the last straw. And this never happened then when I had owners behind each of those individual counters. Of course, everything went the opposite direction. And it launched us, if you will. So the franchising world was a distribution system for what I thought I had, which was a pretty good little business model if run right. So that's the long and short of it. We're 314 stores today. Life is good.
All right. That wraps up part one of episode 8. Obviously, there's a lot to unpack there, so head on over to part 2 to listen to the rest.